It happens that although we have many different places, 40 different places, none of them are in Iowa. That was a major moral failing on our part. But Iowa was not, this was not states that we were doing here. These were places where we had done actual interviews. And Iowa didn't, we happened not to have a sample site in Iowa. Oh, sorry, I'm slow. Yeah, well, and you know, some people were surprised. I'm sorry, I was slow. I didn't pick that up. Some people were surprised that a white place like Iowa would be open to Obama's kind of politics. I wasn't actually, because it's perfectly consistent. Iowa is white. Yeah, it is. Now that doesn't mean what people there are you know somehow. Genetically nicer than anybody else. It is that they, because of the homogeneity, they have a certain level of trust and tolerance. And you can see that it's not something about being Iowan by looking at places in Iowa that have gotten more diverse. And as they've gotten more, there's parts of Iowa that are now quite diverse, and those places are not particularly, were not particularly friendly to Obama's campaign, frankly. I do think, I'm a little reluctant to be much more political. I've already been pretty political, but I do actually think that Obama's candidacy is a remarkable litmus test in this period in America. I think a lot of what he's reflecting is some of our feelings that we've need to we need to create a new sense of us. And I do think that is, it's not an accident that it was in relatively white places where he did well. Sorry for the slowness. Yeah, Eric.
I want to take you up on policy rather than politics. And on this final question of how you created it.
Yeah.
Conservatives say the way to create a new we is to get rid of these distinctions, these categories altogether. So you might find yourself landing from, you know, on Ward Connerly's website instead of Pat Buchanan's website. And so I wonder, how is it that, you know, we should be thinking about making this new?
Well, I think it I'm in favor of integration, but I don't think that that's the mechanism for solving this problem. Indeed, the research here almost directly refutes that idea that integration itself is the solution. I think the solution is, as I tried to say, I'll get to actually specific policies in a second, but as I said before, I think the issue is, are there identities that for at least part of the week trump your racial identity? That is, are there things in which at least part of the time, it could be religion, it could be being a Red Sox or a Patriots or a Celtics fan. I'm not trying to rub that in anybody's face, but Boston is particularly strong these years. So it could be a sports identity. It could be, and some of that will also be some, but I think it's meaning creating new identities. I do think education is important, and I do think that integrated education is actually probably pretty important for that, but not just having people sit in the same classroom. It's creating a sense of identity that is different from and more encompassing of these racial or ethnic sub-identities. Now, it's important, I guess I want to say two more things and then I'll stop. The first is to talk about flag waving. I don't know how many of you probably know this, that the Pledge of Allegiance was not invented in 1776. It was invented in 1906. And it was invented in response to exactly the problem we're talking about now, That is, I pledge allegiance to the Republic. We all know that. And that was invented as a way of saying there's some identity greater than the ethnic identity. Or rather, to put it a different way, it was the transition from an ethnically defined national identity to a civically defined national identity. It was a way of saying, if you believe these things, but you came from Poland, or you came from the shtetl, or you came from Sicily, but you believe these things, you're just as good an American as somebody whose grandparents or ancestors have been here for 200 years, 300 years. And as a mark of that, the interesting thing, I don't know how many of you know this, the Pledge of Allegiance was not, as you might think, a kind of proto-fascist kind of, trying to hold your arm down. The Pledge of Allegiance was invented by socialists as a way of trying to clinch the idea that there was a, you could be perfectly good American and if you believed in these things, even if you had a different ethnic. So I think that, but now progressives, for the most part, are kind of unhappy about nationalism. I think maybe a nationalism is, under certain qualifications, nationalism can be a positive ingredient in a strategy of creating a kind of a new we. The last point I want to make has to do with the issue of bonding and bridging that you actually implicitly were raising. Here's the question. I'll phrase the question first of all in an abstract academic way, and then in an ordinary language way. What's the relationship between bonding social capital and bridging social capital? That's the academic way of phrasing it. Is it like this? So more bonding means less bridging. More bridging means less bonding. Or is it like this? More bonding and means more bridging. That is, are bonding and bridging social capital in a zero-sum relationship or in a positive-sum relationship? Now, if you think that's an extremely abstract way of putting it, think about the scarf controversy in France, right? The French government says Muslim girls can't wear veils in school. That is logically equivalent to saying the only way to get the bridging up, make you really French, is to push the bonding down. That is to say, break up ethnic identities as a way to get people to be really French. All the data that I'm aware of says that's empirically wrong. Empirically, bonding and bridging go together. White Americans who have more white friends have more black friends. And black Americans who have more white friends have more black friends. That is, the distinction is not between bridging and bonding, it's between being connected and not being connected. And the same thing is true for actually almost all these measures, trust. People who trust people who don't look like them tend to be the same people who trust people who do look like them. So, what I'm trying to say is, if you ask me, of course, I'm not saying that bonding always leads to bridging. I'm not saying the way to, develop good relations with your local Baptist is to join the local Al-Qaeda cell. So there are some forms of bonding that don't lead to bridging. But on the whole, bonding, I think, is positively related to bridging, not negatively related to bridging. The way that Italians at the beginning of the 20th century got to be Americans was they joined Italian-American societies. Not that they joined the Rotary right away, they joined Italian-American societies and learned skills and felt increased their comfort level and so on. So I'm inclined to think that the Korean table in the dining hall, seen in dynamic terms, may be a positive and not a negative toward the long-run implication, the long-run objective of a more integrated society. And in that respect, I think I probably do differ from some of my erstwhile conservative friends. Yeah. That's a downside to everything. Well, see, there is a, I don't mean that you believe this, but there is latent in the way we think about this, that there's a kind of a, it's the fifth law of thermodynamics, that there's a total amount of hatred in the world. And the only thing we can choose is whether we direct it towards other people or towards people in our own society. I don't believe that's true, actually. I think it's possible to have a sense of solidarity with other people in your community, that's the nationalism part, without that necessarily producing hostility towards the rest of the world. I don't think empirically, it seems to me implausible that this constant that law of conservation of hatred. That is, there's only a certain amount of things you can do, and if you want to push the hatred down here, well, it's going to come out someplace else. I don't agree with that. But, you know, this is your field more than my field. It's social psychology. It's not political science. Of course nationalism can be misused. Of course it can. But I do think that... Huh? Oh, sure, of course. But that doesn't mean that... Of course. But the fact you can find examples of something being misused doesn't mean that it always has to be misused. I mean, I think feeling proud when Americans of whatever flavor, color, win in the Olympics is not going to make me more likely to want to kind of go off and fight a war with people. Yeah.
Or something more profound, perhaps, more Durkheimian mechanical solidarity. But that's one sort of approach to constructing the we. But the other is what you've also been discussing, is the social network approach, which has people being bonded together through patterns of interaction of one type or another. And I'm wondering if you have a position on which of those two approaches are going to be most fruitful. What kind of mixture of the two approaches is the mixture that you would embrace?
Right, I got the question. It's a really interesting question. I mean, I haven't actually ever phrased it to myself that way. And I my inclination, because I'm not a social theorist or a sociologist, is to want to escape the duality of that and say, well, it's sort of both. I mean, I think in terms of religious, take the area of religion, which I'm conscious of only because I'm working in that field now. I just need to say a word about that because it'll allow me to respond to your question. Over the last 40 or 50 years, there has become an amazing degree of interfaith contact and trust and reciprocity, even though we're divided on those things. More than half of all Americans are married to someone of a different faith than they are, than their current faith. Something like 60% of people are married to someone other than the in a religion other than the religion in which they themselves were raised. And about a third of all Americans are themselves in a religion other than the one in which they were raised. Between a third and a half of all Americans now are in a religion different from the religion they were raised in. If you sort of think about the aggregate effect of that, we are kind of constantly moving around as a people. In the aggregate terms, we're kind of constantly moving. Some Methodists are becoming Jews, some Jews are becoming Catholics, some Catholics are becoming Baptists, some Baptists are becoming whatever. Now, partly that's a social network story. And you can see in the data, one of the most interesting experiences I had was when I was speaking this fall to a group of theologians from the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, which are the most, which are very, very evangelical, very, very fundamentalist, right? And I said, thinking it's wonderful, actually in our data, it turns out that 70%, 80% of all Americans think that people of a different faith can still be saved or go to heaven. And they were appalled at that fact, because it isn't true. And they said, well, at least our Missouri Synod Lutherans wouldn't have that bizarre idea that you could be saved and not be, you know, Christian. And I happened to have the data with me on my laptop, and I said, actually, it's 75% of Missouri Synod Lutherans think that you can be saved, and if you're not, and they were really appalled at that, because they were thinking, how could this possibly be? They're sitting there every week in church, and we tell them that it's not. And the answer is this: everybody has an Uncle Joe, an Aunt Joan, who is something else. And so when you ask them that question, can you be saved if you're not of your religion, they're thinking, well, you know, if anybody's going to go to heaven, it's Aunt Joan, even though she's Catholic. No, I mean that. So now what that sounds like I'm just telling stories. What I meant to be illustrating is those social networks, this constant move, the fact that almost all of us love somebody of a different religion than we are. Almost everybody in America loves someone close. I don't mean just in a generic sense of love, but one of their loved ones worships in someplace else to some other flavor of God. That makes it hard to sustain hostility across racial, across religious lines. Now, is that, that's a social network story. But partly, that happened because of, I believe, because of the cultural veneer, as you put it, of interfaith and we're all tolerant. I mean, I think the language of we're all tolerant was a precondition for the social network changes that has, in fact, then created the reality that it would be really hard, actually, to have a religious war. Americans are very odd in that we are very religious compared to other people, and we're also very tolerant. And that's a function of the fact that we have these networks, personal networks, that cross these lines. But that, in turn, I believe, is a function of the fact that we have this ideology of religious tolerance. So that's why I'm a little bit uncomfortable with trying to choose. Is it the cultural veneer or is it the social networks? Is that making sense? Yes, sir. Latinos.
What was there? I'm pretty sure that the Census Bureau asked for like another for a mix or something like that. Did you throw that data out? And if so, I would be very curious to see what people of mixed race believe.
Well, look, that's my own grandchildren, right? So I mean, it is. I mean, so I'm in human terms, personal terms, I'm very familiar with that, and for sure there's going to be more. Intermarriage across racial and ethnic lines, and the first order effect of that is there are going to be more people like me who sort of are of one, you know, kind of pretty unambiguous category, but who have lots of other people who are of ambiguous stature. And the second order effect is those lines are going to be hard to maintain, as indeed the line between Italian Catholics and Irish Catholics is, you know, the next generation down, you can't maintain that because people aren't any one of those categories. And I think that fundamentally, that's true. I don't want to be dismissive of issues of color because that's obviously relevant, but it's people nowadays young people in America are conscious that color seems to be this thing that we're all hung up on, and often say about this work I'm doing, well, but 100 years ago they were all white, but actually 100 years ago people didn't all see themselves as white. In fact, they saw these Italians as being swarthy, and not, you know, kind of pink, the way proper people are. And if you're really pink the way I am right now, then you're really proper. In other words, I'm even a little skeptical of the idea that I sometimes hear that it's going to be harder to accommodate racial differences, what we now call racial differences, than it was to accommodate those changes 100 years ago. I think, in other words, we today kind of underestimate what a remarkable achievement it was and how hard it was, actually, to break those down 100 years ago. Now, the U.S. Census, of course, has changed exactly how it asks these racial identification questions, and it's now possible to say you're of mixed race. In the end, no matter how you do it, it's arbitrary. That's the fundamental point. And the arbitrariness of it is one of the points I'm trying to make here. That it does change over time and will change over time. And it's not like that we're going to get to the right answer and then we'll be able to hold it there, fix there, because it's constantly changing. It has for the whole history. We've changed the way we divide, and we all change it. So, but the reason that I use that particular fourfold this time is because that's the way the census, for the most part. There are some mixed race people in the U.S. Census for the year 2000, but there are actually not that many people. Most Americans in the census identify themselves as being primarily one of those four categories. That's only to say they just obey the rules, right? And they accepted the categorization, not that there's anything. And that was what my granddaughter was having trouble with, after all, right? That's the point. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Those are folks who are also very cosmopolitan-oriented as opposed to multiculturally-oriented, against identity politics, against public programs that try to highlight or bring to the public surface racial or ethnic identities as opposed to a more encompassing cosmopolitan identity. And so I'm wondering, when you tell that story just before about how, on the one hand, you're searching for context in which we will have something that allows us to trump our racial or ethnic identities, but on the other hand, you say, in sort of good old multicultural fashion, the Korean eating table looks like a possibly good development. I can't quite make sense of the Hollinger-esque or Rorty-esque parts of expanding the circle of the we and the pro-multicultural element that the Korean eating table is.
Right. I don't know, honestly. I'm very, very empirical, and I don't feel comfortable, you probably can tell, I don't feel comfortable dealing in these large abstract, ideological abstractions. Because I can think of examples, real examples. I use the example of the Italian-American clubs, which unquestionably, historically, were an important, over time, transition into the Rotary Club, right? So you went through the, you went from, forget about Italian-American, you went from the Italian folks huddling together in the north end of Boston in a purely Italian, not even Italian-American, but Italian setting, to Italian-Americans, to, you know, a generation or two, they're all Rotarians. And so that's clearly a case, it seems to me, in which the analog would be the Korean table becomes the whatever. And I don't believe that this was the point I was making in my language about bridging and bonding. I don't believe there's fundamentally any incompatibility between bridging and bonding. I don't think you've got to choose. I think all of us have multiple identities all the time. Some of the time I'm a Red Sox fan. Some of the time I'm a WASP whose family have been here for 400 years. Some of the time I'm the loving grandfather of a Latino kid, and it's not like I sort of wake every morning and say, well, now which am I going to be today? They're all there together. So I'm not responding to your question fully because I don't actually feel, either personally or as an empiricist looking at the data, that they're...
So you want to reconstruct the identities, racial ethnic identities that we have. You don't mean necessarily you want them to be less salient for any individual. You maybe want them to be less salient all the time.
Yeah, and I also want them to be less salient to other people, actually. I mean, that's the point I was trying to make when I talked about Roger and Betty Borgazzani. She knows inside out, she knows she's Italian, but Irish. But it's not like she goes around with a little green shamrock on her forehead so that everybody knows that she's Irish, right? I mean, that's not the first, it's not even the 12th thing you'd say about her. It's probably the third thing she, if you ask her, who are you? She'd say, I'm a nurse, I'm a grandmother, I'm a proud daughter of Ireland. That's probably where she would put it, but nobody else would put it there. And that's not, I mean, there may be some sociological language for describing what I'm, this distinction between the identity as seen from inside out and the identity as seen from outside in. Is there something I should read on that issue? Yeah.
Maybe I just haven't done enough background reading, but I was wondering, in terms of the problems in community engagement, why can't the main problem or the cause of that be just that people who are more work-focused instead of relationship-focused are drawn to urban areas, and as a result, the place is more diverse?
Well, it could be that people are... It isn't being work focused exactly. Let me sort of think through exactly. It's not urban. Remember, we're holding constant a lot of stuff in the background. So what you have to think about is we've got two people living in neighborhoods that are essentially the same economic level, the same degree of same number of people working or not working there. There are a lot of things that we're holding constant. The only difference is this place is very homogeneous. This census tract is very homogeneous. It's all Chinese or it's all white or whatever. And this one is very diverse. They're both urban. They're both equally rich. They're both equally educated. The thing that we vary between these two is the ethnic composition. And the person who's living in the more ethnically diverse one is more hunkered down. So it can't be that they're drawn there by the work, because we've controlled for that. You'd have to say that the people who are more relationship, as you put it, relationship-centered, would have to be drawn to homogeneous places. That's the direction that would have to be. Well, keep in mind, I recognize I sort of induced this confusion, but let me see if I can clarify the confusion. When I was showing the big charts, I was using places that were individual places that were either urban or rural or whatever. But when I actually went to the serious math of the analysis, I was using individuals and linking them to their census tracts. And I was holding constant many, many things. So the way to think about it is I was looking at two Angelenos who were living in the same degree of urbanness and the same degree of wealth or poverty. But one of them happened to be in a very homogeneous enclave, and one of them was in a very heterogeneous place. But that's what I mean when I say I've controlled in the background for a lot of these things. You can't see that in the aggregate level charts that where I had places names, but when I went down to individuals, I'm able to do that. Is that more or less clear? Yeah.
I have to say that I've known this guy since we were both 17 years old.
That's true.
Bob Putnam graduated.
At least 30 years ago, that was.
Bob Putnam graduated first in the college class where we both went, Swarthmore. The smartest thing we did in college was to marry women from the same place. And I'm grateful to Bob for having graduated first in our class, because it made the bottom half of the class possible, and that was me.
Jeff, come on.
My question has to do with global warming and whether or not the higher level of we could possibly, these very interesting dynamic changes have their own history with no particular external force influences.
Yeah, but
something like this possibly holds together in ways that we have never seen.
Well, that's a really good question, Jeb. It's a really incisive question, because on the one hand, it's going to be harder to solve global warming because we've got to get such a diverse group of people together. That is, global warming requires us to, if you think in terms of the question we ask about would you trust other people to conserve, and the more diverse your census tract, the less you'd trust people to conserve. So that says, what's it going to be like if we've got to trust the Indians or the Chinese or the Russians or the British or somebody to cut back on their usage too? It's hard. That captures one aspect of why it's hard, because it's not just they're another country, it's that they're different from us. And we don't quite know, suppose we went along, would they come along? We don't know. That's the downside. The upside is these external threats that threaten all of us do have the possibility of being a challenge that makes us see ourselves as one we. So I think that requires political skill, actually. I think this is in part a political problem, a political opportunity. Right.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time, so I want to call it to a close now and thank you.
Thank you all.